All right, if you're in here, then you're ready for some good old-fashioned Old Testament study, all right? We're starting our study of the book of Numbers. I guess it's important to mention that, although it fits really well on a slide. So we look at the book of Numbers. I don't know, what do you guys think of when you think of the book of Numbers? What do you think of? Numbers, excellent, yes. Obviously, right? Any guesses as to why we call it the book of Numbers or why it's called the book of Numbers? Recounting people. And so actually, the first significant word in the text is census. And you see that that they take a census in verse 2 of chapter 1. And we'll kind of talk about this, but it's kind of bookend. Where are we time frame-wise with the book of Numbers? Do you remember? What's going on? What's happening? What's that? We're out of Egypt, yes. We're still at Sinai, all right? When we're starting the book of Numbers, we're still at Sinai. So Genesis gives you, like, you know, everything up to Joseph. Then you go into Exodus, and Exodus is essentially, you know, exiting out of Egypt. That's the way I like to think about it. And Exodus ends at Sinai, and while they're at Sinai, we get Leviticus, which is, you know, the full, complete law, and the law of and concerning the Levites, the book of Leviticus, how does an unholy man approach a holy God, and then Numbers starts. We're still at Sinai, all right? So Moses is doing a lot of writing there at Sinai. I guess he's just really inspired there, and we record the events that take place. So Numbers is bookended with a census at Sinai, and then a census before they go into the, you know, before the book of Deuteronomy, and the Deuteronomy is kind of a second giving of the law just before they go into the Promised Land. It's bookended with two censuses. What census? I don't know how you say it. But anyway, so if we look at that, why the two? Why one now at the beginning of the book and one at the end? What happens between these two bookends? What's that? Yes, there's more than three, right? There's a lot of wandering Jews, so they're wandering around in the desert. And so here's some information while we're talking about this. So we get a lot of what's happening as they're wandering around. Now, why did they have to be wandering around for 40 years? Did they have to be? Was that just like, you know, the plan? What was the plan? Where were they supposed to be going? From Sinai, they're going to go where? Straight to the Promised Land, and we're going to take over, and it's going to be awesome. And did that happen? No, it didn't. They rebelled against God. Numbers is a book of rebellion, in my opinion. It's those who initially came out of Egypt and God getting Egypt out of the people. That was a problem. There was still too much Egypt in the people. They were still too much relying on their former lives and how they were before and that kind of stuff. So these kind of things had to take place. And so they rebelled against God. And then what did God tell them when they rebelled against him? Well, we're obviously going to be covering this. But what did he tell them when they rebelled against him and said, well, we can't go in there. We're like grasshoppers. You know, God, we can't do it. The spies, remember the 12 spies? There were two faithful spies. What did God say that he was going to do with the rest of the people? You're going to die. So all the warriors, and we'll talk about the warriors tonight. Basically, 20 years of age and up, we're all going to die in the desert. So basically, the book of Numbers, that's why we have the second census, is all right, after we've purified those who died in the wilderness, we take another census, right? And we see these are the ones that are going to actually go in. All right, and these are the ones that are going to actually go into the land. So it's kind of, here's the faithless and the faithful, and a lot of dying in between, okay? A lot of happening. Like, there's some crazy events that happen in the book of Numbers. Like, a ground opens up and swallows thousands of people, and they still rebel against God after that. At that point, the ground opens up and swallows you up. And you see all these different people getting swallowed up because they're rebelling against God. And the ground closes back up like nothing ever happened. Then, like the next chapter, they're rebelling against God. The whole ground is lava. Have you played that game when you were a kid? All right, God could swallow you up at any minute and you're still going to mouth off. I don't understand, but anyway, I wasn't there, right? So that happens. So here are the things that are happening. Some things to take into account with the book of Numbers. Into account. Anyway, sorry. All right, so here is a brief outline, a workable outline. I don't know if you've ever got outlines from your teachers, and it's just like, this is like reading the Silmarillion. Here's an outline that's more workable. And so getting understanding of what's happening. The first nine chapters, Israelites are preparing, as they're still kind of there at Sinai. And we're going to be looking at six of these chapters. So we're going to be trying to take off, you know, as we study together each night, six chapters a night. So here are some things that are happening with these first nine chapters. And then we start getting into chapters 10 through 12. And the Israelites are traveling in the wilderness, and they go, and they're supposed to take over the promised land, and that does not happen. And so they were unfaithful in that. So these are some of the events that take place. I'm not going to read them because you guys can read, right? Okay, excellent. I believe in you. All right. 13 through 19, we have a severe punishment for disobedience. Unfaithfulness to God, a lot of that happens. What's interesting is that this section or this time frame with the Israelites was actually used later on in the New Testament to talk about the disobedience that we can learn. Here's what you learn. You know, these things were written, and we learn not to be disobedient because the ground can swallow you up. So these things were written that we will understand and can be talked about with future generations. About what not to do. The last chapters of Numbers 20 through 26, this generation of the Israelites that are going to go in and attempt to take the land. And obviously they don't go in the book of Numbers, but these are the ones that are kind of poised. So the book of Numbers ends and they're poised on going into the promised land before Moses gives what is called the second giving of the law, Deuteronomy, and which are essentially three sermons of Moses preaching at them. Don't mess this up, okay? Don't turn things around here. You need to keep going with God. And so these are kind of a workable outline with the book of Numbers. All right, looking in the first few chapters 1 through 6, 1 through 9, preparing to enter, and you know, had all things gone well, they would have marched right into the land, and the book of Numbers would have been truncated. Maybe it would have been added on to Leviticus or grouped in with Deuteronomy, but things happened differently. And so when we look at chapter 1, we're looking at the warrior census, right? We're not counting every single man, woman, and child when we take a census, not like what they do today, right? This is a warrior census, which is interesting. Have they fought yet? Now that they're here at Sinai, have they already had a battle? They've had a battle already, right? And Joshua had to lift his hands up and that kind of stuff. But they weren't organized like, you know, just like to the fray. So they weren't organized like they would be now. So in this situation, we're getting organized. And in the first few verses here, verses 1 through 19, God chose, I'm working on my past tense. God chose some leaders to lead the families, the different families. Of the Israelites, the different tribes. And in verses, beginning of verse 5, you see, these are the names of the men who stand with you. And he begins naming these men. And these leaders were chosen by God. Verse 17 says, these names, so Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by name. God chose by name these men to lead the different tribes. And so they were the commanders, they were the commanders on the field, and they were the leaders of the household of the different tribes at that time. And so we're not going to go through and read all these names. If you guys want to practice your diction, you can do that. But these are the names that are listed here in which tribe they pertain to. Moses and Aaron, they now at this point are before the people. And so they begin to take a record. Look at what he says in verse 18. And they assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month, They registered by ancestry in their families, by their father's household, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, head by head, just as the Lord had commanded. Which you're going to see that phrase throughout the book of Numbers, just as the Lord commanded. God said to Moses, do this. They did item X of God, just as the Lord commanded. Is that a good kind of like system to follow? God says, do this. I do it just as the Lord commanded. If I do something just as the Lord commanded, would it enter into my head to say, well, he didn't say I couldn't do this, right? Do you have kids that do that? Well, you didn't say I couldn't. We might have children that do that. What's that? We twist things sometimes, right? Are children the only ones? Are there adults that do that? Maybe. I'm not asking you to raise hands, right? But just as so, that's a good way to deal. So you'll see that pattern throughout the book of Numbers, and then you'll see the ones that don't do it just as the Lord commands. And so they begin to count. In verse 20, we have the sons of Reuben. What's our number for Reuben? 46,500 warriors, right, for Reuben. And so then, now we're going to go by, you know, start looking at tribe by tribe, what warriors they have. Do you guys have them kind of like, you know, punctuated in your text there where you can, which tribe is the biggest tribe? Which one had the most warriors in it? Judah, yeah, Judah is the biggest one, 74,600. Which one was the smallest one? What's that? Manasseh has 32, right? But what was their total? How many warriors did they have? Verse 46. You can do some damage with 603,550 men who are backed by God. If a valiant warrior fights as though God is on his side, does it take much? What are some numbers of men that fought on behalf of God, who fought and were said that they were brave, valiant men? There were 300 men that fought thousands of people, right? There's one that's taken 800 people, right? So it's possible for this amount of men, if they all fight with a heart like those kind of people, there's nothing that's going to stop them, right? Nothing's going to stop them. And even so, whenever they're fighting against, so they take Jericho. I went blank on a name. They take Jericho initially, right? It falls. They don't know about the sin in the camp, and they send just 5,000 out to take Ai. So they're not every time they march, they're not sending out all 600,000 people to every campaign. Right? They're kind of dispersing. But it's interesting to think about that in logistics-wise. Now, beginning of verse 47, who's exempt from this? The Levites, right? Not because they're conscientious objectors, but because they're dedicated to a different purpose, right? They can't be, like, imagine if the Levites went out, and they're out, you know, killing folk, and then they come back in, they're unclean. They can't serve, so they have to be set apart. And so there's something about that they're exempted from that. They have another service, another role they fill. And so they are not numbered among them. Only verse 49 says, only tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. We will be taking a census of them in a moment. But verse 51, what are we looking at here as far as what the Levites are supposed to be doing? Verse 51. They're doing what? They're the ones setting up the tent, right? When you go camping, it's dad that sets up the tent, right? Sometimes. It's hopefully somebody very capable sets up the tent with all the folding rods. Would you imagine this might be a little more complicated than, you know, a Coleman tent, pop-up tent? I think just a wee bit. But we'll talk about that later on. They divide it up. But the Levites are the ones that are taking care of the tent, the tabernacle and all its furnishings and everything like that. But verse 53, where is their camping spot? When you pull into, if you've ever gone camping in your life, and you pull into a spot to go camping, where's their spot to go camping? They're camping around the tabernacle. They are kind of like this physical barrier between anybody else, any rando, walking up to the tabernacle. And we'll see that if anybody random starts walking up to the tabernacle at a time when they're not supposed to, guess what happens? Yeah, they die. It's bad. Bad news bears. A lot of death, okay? A lot of, like, you cannot do these things. And we'll talk about that a little bit later tonight about why. But they're going to camp around the tabernacle, around the tent. That's their spot. And then we start, in chapter 2, we start talking about the arrangement of the camps. And so there's camping and marching instructions as we go through. And so the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "The sons of Israel shall camp each by his own standard with the banners of their fathers' households, and they shall camp around the tent of the meeting place at a distance." From it? We don't know the distance, but at a distance, they're camping away from the tabernacle, because you got to have room for the Levites and all their tents and everything, and then you got to camp out from them. And then you just want some nice walking space, and you don't want to be too close to somebody else's tent because you hear about them fussing and fighting all the time, and you know how it is, right? Okay, so there's at a distance. We need some space here. And so they're camping. And so on the east side, beginning of verse 3, toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah, by their armies, and the leader of the sons of Judah and his army gives the number here, and the tribe of Issachar and the tribes of Zebulun. And they're going to be the ones on the east. And the total number of these gives them, and also it gives them their marching orders. When are they supposed to leave out? These three tribes, when do they leave out? First, right? Which is prime place. If you're traveling in a line of maybe a million plus people, where do you want to be in that column? I would like to be at the front, right? Because why? Dust, right? You think about that? All those people marching ahead of you. And then the ruts, you know, for your carts and that kind of stuff, if you have them. I just can't imagine. So anyway, that's logistics, but we'll get that aside. So on this, verse 10, on the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben, right? Reuben, and by their standards. And then those next camp to them, Simeon, verse 14, Gad, and talks about their total number. And then they shall be set out second. This group in that order will set out second. And then the tent of the meeting shall set out, verse 17. And so then the Levites leave. So there's six tribes heading out. And then the Levites and their procession and everything, they head out. And then you have those that are camped on the west side, the standard of the Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, beginning of verse 18. They head out. And then on the north side, you have Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And then they head out and set out. So they're Naphtali, poor guy, poor tribe Naphtali. They're at the very end of the column as they travel. Maybe there's enough space between the dust settles. I don't know, but they have to follow them. Is it significant that the Levites are in the center? Why is that? Why is that significant? Is that just happenstance? So it's protected on both sides, right, front and back. So there's protection afforded it. I mean, those are costly items you're traveling around out in the middle of nowhere with. What else? Yes, so there's that visual concept that's there. Anything else? What's that? Yeah, so and that's another big part of it, is that God is always at the center. When they're marching, God's in the center. When they're camping, God's in the center. And the Levites are there around them. And so there's that concept of the presence of God everywhere they go. They see this presence of God everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. It's in everything. And so we see that even in marching. It was not by accident that they're placed there in the middle. And it's not by accident that they're still being led by a visible representation of God. The Shekinah glory of God leads them. And so they continue to see that throughout. Now, in chapter 3, we have some information about the Levites, but here's kind of some representation of what that camp might have looked like. Maybe they camped this way. This is one way of looking at it. And what's also, we'll talk about this in a second, but you see the three different sons of the tribe of Levi, the main sons, and then Aaron and Moses, they camp at the head there of the entrance into the tent of meeting or the tabernacle. So that's one representation. Here's another. Can y'all see that? That might be a little closer. I wouldn't want my tent necessarily that close to somebody, but you know. In this case, they have nice wide avenues to travel down. I don't know if they put like, it says there's standards, that they put up standards so you know like which tribe was which. And here's another representation. So we're talking about a lot of people in an area to camp, right? It's bigger than any state park. You know, you go to a state park, they don't have campsites this big for this many people, right? It's bigger than Woodstock out here, right? So they're all camping out here in order to do this. You need a lot of land to do that. And so this is maybe what it looked like. So anyway, that gives us an idea of the camp and how things were set up and organized. And you camped and you slept according to those things, which means you couldn't have a sleepover with somebody who's in another tribe. That just didn't work out. This is where you're going to be. So those are things maybe you don't think about very often, but the details, the day-to-day life. Okay. So chapter 3 and 4 concerning the Levites, we get into more detail about them, and we get some understanding of what's going on. In verse 1 of chapter 3, so these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses and the time when the Lord spoke with Moses at Sinai. And then these are the names of the son of Aaron, Nadab, the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Two names we know here already. Nadab and Abihu. What happened to them? Yeah, verse 4 kind of reminds everybody again what happened. But what's interesting, did they have any children? They had no children. That's an interesting comment. So Nadab and Abihu died. They're not there. So Eleazar and Ithamar are up on deck. And so verse 5, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before Aaron the priest that they might serve him, and they shall perform the duties for him, the whole congregation, before the tent of meeting to do the service of the tabernacle. And so the Levites, again, are getting instruction about what their duties are going to be specifically and what they're going to be keeping. In verse 12, it says, now behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel instead of every firstborn. And so every firstborn, was, God said, those are mine, but he's taken the tribe of Levi kind of in place as being sacred to him. So the Jewish nation, the Israelite nation, is a sacred nation unto God. And within that nation, there's a sacred priestly tribe that kind of represents those who would have been the firstborn. And so the Levite shall be mine, he says in verse 12. And he says in verse 13, for all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctify unto myself all the firstborn in Israel, from man to beast, they shall be mine. I am the Lord. And so there is that sacrifice that needs to be made in connection with that. Verse 15, number the sons of Levi by their fathers' households, by their families, every male from a month old and upward you shall number. And so we're numbering every male from a month old up. These are not—they're not going into war. They're not. That's not happening. And verse 17: these are the sons of Levi by their names: Gershon, Gothan, and Merari. And so those become kind of like the head, the households that we're counting under. And so we begin looking at these things. So in verse 21 of Gershon, was a family of the Libnites and the family of the Simeonites. These were the families of the Gershonites. Their numbered men and the numbering of every male from a month old and upward, even their numbered men were 7,500. And so it talks about where they camped. So the families of the Gershonites were to camp behind the tabernacle westward. All right? And it talks about the leaders there as well. And then their duties, verse 25, the duties of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involve the tabernacle and the tent, its covering and the screen for the doorway, the tent of meeting, and the hangings of the court and the screen of the doorway, and the court which is around the tabernacle and the altar, and its cords according to all the service concerning them. So they were in charge of the tarps, all the different layers, and the seal skins, the different colors, and the badger skins, and all those things that were made up. And so not only did they carry those things, but they maintained them and make sure that they were, you know, up to snuff and nothing, there was no tearings in them and anything. And so they are the ones maintained those items and then made sure that they carried those items. There's three families here. We're going to divide the tabernacle into three different sections. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you, which one of these would you want to be carrying at the end of the day? Which one? So maybe you want to be carrying all the tarps and all the sashes and all the ropes and all that kind of stuff. Maybe that would be, you think, the easiest one to carry. So if you think that's the easiest one to carry, then you're going to be with the tribe with those of Gershon. Of Kohath was the family of the Armonites, the family of Israelites, and the family of the Hebronites, and the family of the Uzielites, were the families of the Kohathites. A lot of ites. And in the numbering of every male from the month old upward, there were 8,600 performing the duties of the sanctuary. The families of the sons of Kohath were to camp southward side of the tabernacle, the leader of the fathers, and gives the name there. Now their duties involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, the utensils, the sanctuary, with their minister and the screen, and all the service concerning them. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, was the chief of the leaders of the Levi. He had oversight of those who performed the duties of the sanctuary. So Eleazar is going to be in charge of these items. So these things that are going to be ported, he's going to make sure that they're done and transported correctly. Do we ever have an example of where these items were transported incorrectly? Who transported them incorrectly? David did. Silly David. We have instructions on how to transport these things, right? And David decided, well, let's make a new cart. Incidentally, that's a great sermon title, David's New Cart. So he did things wrong, right? He chose poorly on how to do things. We have instructions on who's supposed to do it, and we'll see even more instruction later on tonight. So they're going to carry all those utensils and these things that are, you know, you don't open them and your face is going to melt off kind of thing. You can't touch them because you will die. So these are hazardous materials you're going to be transporting. Verse 33, Merari was a family of the Maholites and the family of the Mushites. These are the families of Merari. And their number, men, 6,200 from a month old and upward. And the leader of this household, and they were camping on the north side of the tabernacle. And the duties that they had involved the frames, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, which its sockets were like solid silver. Like it's like they put them on the ground and then they slid the socket, the beams down into them. So we're talking about some hefty items that they're carrying around and these beams and everything. And so that's what they carry around. Their pegs, the sockets, the cords and all kind of stuff. They're the ones that are carrying those things. And before the tabernacle, eastward, Moses and Aaron, like I said, at the entry, that's where they're going to be camping. What does it say about the layman? But the layman coming near was to be throttled and sent his way. What happens to anybody who wanders in to this area they weren't supposed to be? Die, right? They kill them till they die of it, verse 38. So that's not good. And the 39, so all the, you add all that up, we're like 22,000 people. And so all the firstborn males by the number of the names of a month old and upward were numbered 22,273. Because they were supposed to number all the number of men firstborn from a month old and up in Israel to balance things out. And they I'm not even putting these up here, am I? I'm sorry. I make these slides, I don't use them. Yes, ma'am. Oh, they did. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to think that they had beasts of burden to help move these things. Now, some things you couldn't, right? Like the ark and that kind of stuff. There had poles, and you had to walk through it, and any old person couldn't carry that. So there were certain things that were in place to carry certain utensils. But I imagine if they're carrying all these giant tarps and things that they use for covering, that they're folding these things up and putting them on a wagon of some sort and carrying them some way. And we'll see some more instruction about that in just a moment. But yes, there were prescribed ways of carrying these things and prescribed ways of making sure it was done in a way. I imagine it was easier than other things. And we got to hurry if we're going to get through six chapters. So looking at this, so they at the end of this chapter, we talk about this kind of making sure it's even, and they have to pay because there's more people. And so they have to pay, kind of buy back their representation amongst the tribe of Israel. And so they do that, and they pay. What does it say here? You shall take 5 shekels apiece per head of those that are, there's more people, and so they have to make that restitution there at the end of the chapter. Let's see if we get all this up here. Yeah, let's go ahead and put all those up there. And so now we look over in chapter 4, and the duties, and the Lord spoke to Moses again. So there's this, like, are you picking up on this? God spoke to Moses. Moses did the thing God said, and they did the thing God said. It's kind of how we go through a lot of these first chapters. And so they get instruction about taking a census of the descendants of Kohath from among the sons of Levi by their families and by their father's households from 30 years upward even to 50 years old. All who entered the service to do the work in the tent of meeting. So now we're taking a census. We took a census of those males, month old and upward. And now we're taking a census of those who are going to be doing what? Between the ages of 30 and 50 is when you're going to be doing what? What's that? Well, serving in the tent of meeting. Yeah, so that's your window. You got 20 years of service in serving in the tent of meeting here in verse 3. And this is the work of the descendants of Kohath in the day in the tent of meetings concerning the most holy things. And so when the camp is set out, Aaron and his sons shall go in, and they shall take down the veil, the screen, and cover the ark of the testimony with it. So there was this. You couldn't just walk into the most holy place and say, well, we're breaking the place down. It's kind of taking everything apart, you know, and just kind of come in with your construction belt and everything like that. It was still reverent, right? It was still, God was still there. His presence was still there. So Aaron and sons go in and they cover everything up. And they cover everything up so you can't see it. And then they could go in and carry them out and get them transported. But Aaron and sons had to go in first. And later on it says that to make sure things are covered so that the sons of Kohath don't keep dying when they go in. Because if they went in and they hadn't prepared it for leaving, they would just, what happens? Blah, fall over dead. So we don't want that happening. So they have to cover the ark. And they shall lay a covering of porpoise skin on it and shall spread it with cloth of pure blue and shall insert its poles. Poor dolphins. Okay, anyway, so table of bread, they're going to be carrying that as well. Verse 7, and talks about spreading the material over it and a cloth of scarlet material. And then verse 9, the lampstand, they're going to, in all its trays and all, everything goes with it, all its various and sundry items. And then over the golden altar, and they shall spread a blue cloth over it with a covering of porpoise skin. Those porpoises. All right. And they shall take all the utensils of service. And it's interesting here, it says when they carry everything with it, in verse 13, they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread purple cloth over it. Now this isn't like every single grain of, these are like the big chunks of ash that have like the fat that was been sprinkled on it. Have y'all seen that before? If you cooked a big piece of meat over a fire and that meat drips on the ashes and it kind of puts those ashes out. And then when you start the fire up the second time, it's a whole lot easier to start it, and it smells amazing. So those are the ashes. Those are the ashes that are being taken with them. Not all the little fine white ones that are kind of just like just blow in the wind. They're talking about these big chunks of that are going to be taken with them from the altar. And so those things are marching with them. And that's going to be under the responsibility of Eleazar, verse 16. And so, again, the sons of Kohath will be, so they will not touch the objects, and so they won't die. In verse 15, is kind of that warning there. He says, make sure you're covering everything up before you send them in there to take it away, otherwise they're just going to die. And so that's important there, and that's Eleazar's responsibility to make sure that happens. And they go in and they assign who's carrying what in verse 19. And the Gershonites, verse 21, the Lord spake to Moses, saying, take the census of the sons of Gershon by their fathers, 30 years upward, again, the same kind of thing, and servicing and carrying and everything that they're supposed to be doing. And it talks about the loads that they're going to be carrying. Now, what are they going to be doing? What did we say earlier they're going to be carrying? The Gershonites. If you were Team Gershonite and you wanted to carry the curtains, the porpoise skins, all the badger skins, various things made of skins and various colors and things like that, that's going to be your job. And so that talks about the things that they're going to be doing and how they'll be doing it. And that's after, you know, these holy things have been kind of taken out of the way, they've been processed, ready for transport. Then you go in and take all the coverings down. And so the Merarites, the sons of Merari, you're going to come in next, and basically you're left with the skeleton at this point. So there's a census of these guys, and 30 years and up, and they're the ones that are carrying the framework of the tabernacle and everything they're supposed to be doing, and that's going to be under the direction of Ithamar. So Ithamar is in charge of the framework and the tent coverings, and then Eleazar is in charge of all the holy things, okay? It's because he's the oldest son that's still left, and so he's in charge of those things. And so they talk about these events, and he talks about the numbering of the Kohathites, the numbered by their families, in verse 36. And the numbered men of the sons of Gershon are 2,630, and Merari 3,200, and talks about those that are going to be working. From 30 years up and upward, and their numbered men were 8,580, and according to the commandment of Moses. And so here is what God has prescribed. Now imagine they're working in this way as a family unit. And if you're a family that is in charge of these things, as a child, you're seeing these things happen, right? You're seeing your parents work in this capacity. You're seeing these things happen on the daily. You're understanding about all the details and ins of out to make sure that, oh, Uncle so-and-so almost touched the ark one day. Oh, and so you're hearing about all this kind of stuff all the time because your life is centered around taking care of these things and your family as a family of priests that takes care of the things concerning God. Does that have any translation into events for today? Slightly, right? Who are we? A chosen priesthood, right? A chosen people, a royal priesthood, as what Peter would write concerning us today. If we, as the people of God, talk about godly things on the regular basis and talk about the things concerning God, and that's regular communication in our household, and they see these things, and they know that we're always going to be going up to the tabernacle, metaphor, so to speak, does that become a part of your family? It becomes a part of your family language. Becomes a part of the habits, it becomes a part of all the things that you do, becomes a part of your vocabulary. Do you see how that continues to, that builds a culture within a family? And that's what's happening with these Levitical families as they're doing this. Of course, the whole tribe, but more so the Levitical families. In chapter 5, we talk about defilement and adultery. Dun, dun, dun. So defilement in the things that they have to get these things out of the camp. Chapter 5, verse 2, command the sons of Israel that they send away to the camp every leper and anybody having a discharge. Leviticus chapter 15, if you want to look into the details on that, and everyone who was unclean because of a dead person. Leviticus 13 and 14 deal specifically with those who are lepers and everything concerning that. And so all those people have to be put away. The camp has to be pure in relationship to being there with God. And it says, verse 3, the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. This is key. Look at Leviticus chapter 15 very quickly. Leviticus 15, 31. Concerning these, it sounds harsh, God, that you're doing this thing. It says, thus keep the sons of the Israel separate from their uncleanness, so they will not die in their uncleanness by their defiling my tabernacle that is among them. And so there is an important that there is those things that are unclean are stay away. It's for everybody's good that those things stay separate. And so there is some instruction there about defilement. And then we go into this adultery test is what you might have in some of your headings at the last part of this chapter. But really, it's a jealousy situation. If you look at the end of chapter 5, you see that this is it says, where is it? Verse 14, rather. If a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife and she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself. And so it's more of a jealousy issue than it is necessarily what the woman has or hasn't done. Now, there's prescription. If a man suspects that his wife has been unfaithful, then there's prescription of what they're supposed to do. They go to the tent, and they take some water, and they put it in a vessel, and they take dust from the ground of the where the tabernacle is, because where the tabernacle is, that ground is holy. Excellent. So we put that in there, and then she has to hold the grain offering in her hands that the husband was supposed to bring, and then there's more. What else? Then there's he talks about the oath in verse 20 and 21 and about what she's supposed to say. And then she drinks this stuff, okay? This bitter water is what it says. And what does the text tell us happens if she is or is not? What happens? In verse 21. If she has not been unfaithful, then nothing happens to her and she's going to bear a son or bear a child. She'll have children. But if she has been unfaithful, the thigh withers and the belly bloats out. And that becomes kind of like a sign of like she is a cursed woman, right? So not a beauty thing. It's the opposite, obviously. And so again, in verse 27, her abdomen will swell and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But verse 29, this is a law of jealousy. Again, more I think it's protecting a woman from a man and jealousy than it is necessarily about infidelity, the way the text is reading. And so it talks about this spirit of jealousy. Verse 31 is interesting. Moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but the woman shall bear her guilt. And this is not saying that a man is free from any kind of infidelity. That's not at all what's being said. If you want to write out here Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, that anybody who's an adulterer, both will die, right? Both are supposed to die. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about in this instance, if she has been unfaithful, then he's freed from her. It's not talking about that he can kind of do whatever he wants, but a woman can't. That's not what it's saying. Just want to make sure it's being read correctly. And then chapter 16, we have chapter 6, rather, very quickly, the Nazarite vow, the law of the Nazarite. Can anybody think of anybody who took the Nazarite vow? Samson, right? Probably the most famous. Wasn't exactly a poster child for somebody taking the Nazarite vow, because usually it's somebody supposed to be holy and chaste and those kind of things, and Samson wasn't always that way, but he's probably one. And you also, it's possible it's possible that John was a Nazarite as well. It talks about him from his birth not drinking any wine or strong drink. It doesn't say specifically that he was a Nazarite. Also, being a Nazarite was not necessarily a thing you did for your life. You could say, I'm going to take this Nazarite vow for X amount of time. And you designated that time. And it's possible that Paul, in Acts chapter 18:18, he's talked about shaving his head because he took a vow. You shaved your head as you kind of left that vow. Anyway, it's possible that he had done that, taken that vow at that time as well. So anyway, that's the Nazarite vow. And then we have Aaron's blessing to finish off chapter 6. If you look at this blessing, beginning in verse 20, it says, Thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Were some of you singing that? You have sung it, right? So this is, again, a song. It's hard for me to read that and not sing it. So anyway, that is the first six chapters of the book of Numbers. We'll be continuing this class next Wednesday. Thank you very much for your time this evening.